Well, going back to Gonzalez, the president's counsel then, he transmitted to the president the conclusion of the Justice Department that the president has the authority to rescind the Geneva Conventions. It's the supreme law of the land under the U.S. Constitution and the foundation of modern international humanitarian law. And Gonzalez advised the president that this would be a good idea. In his words, it substantially reduces the threat of domestic criminal prosecution of administration officials under the War Crimes Act of 1996, which carries the death penalty for grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. So he better rescind them quickly. Well, we can see right on today's front pages why the Justice Department was right to be concerned that the president and his advisors might be subject to the death penalty under the laws passed by the Republican Congress in 1996. And of course, under the principles of Nuremberg, if anyone took them seriously. 2 weeks ago, on the front page of the New York Times, prominently displayed, was a picture of Fallujah General Hospital. The accompanying story said, patients and hospital employees were rushed out of rooms by armed soldiers and ordered to sit or lie on the floor while troops tied their hands behind their backs. And that's what the picture shows, armed soldiers standing over people lying, patients and doctors lying on the floor with their hands tied behind their backs. And that's described in the stories, in the front page stories, an important achievement. Quote, New York Times, it shut down a propaganda weapon for the militants. Fallujah General Hospital had been producing a stream of reports of civilian casualties, and these inflated figures, I mean inflated because our leader so declares, were inflaming opinion throughout the country and the region, driving up the political costs of the conflict. Incidentally, the word conflict is by now a common euphemism for U.S. aggression, as when we read on the same front pages that the U.S. must now rebuild what the conflict just destroyed. A conflict has no agent. It's kind of like a hurricane. It happens, and then we have to come in and rebuild it. Well, let's go back to the picture and the story about the closing of the propaganda weapon, the main hospital. There are some relevant documents, including the Geneva Conventions. So here's a principle of the Geneva Conventions. Fixed establishments and mobile medical units of the medical service may in no circumstances be attacked and shall at all times be respected and protected by parties to the conflict. So page one of the world's leading newspaper is cheerfully depicting war crimes for which the political leadership could be sentenced to death under U.S. law. No wonder that the Attorney General warned the president, as his counsel, that he should use the constitutional authority that the Justice Department concocted to rescind the supreme law of the land, adopting the concept of presidential sovereignty devised by Hitler's primary legal advisor, the true Eminence Grise of the Bush administration, according to a distinguished conservative authority on constitutional law, writing in perhaps the most respectable and sober journal in the country. Well, the world's greatest newspaper also tells us, quoted, that the U.S. military achieved nearly all their objectives in Fallujah well ahead of schedule, leaving much of the city in smoking ruins. But it was not, I'm quoting it, but it was not a complete success. Why? There was little evidence of dead pack rats in their warrens or the streets. Those are their words, not mine. They did find a body of a dead woman, though it's not known whether she was an Iraqi or a foreigner. That's the only question that's raised, and apparently the only one that comes to mind. This is all right in the front pages of the world's greatest newspaper. The front page account also quotes a Marine commander who says, it ought to go down in the history books. Perhaps it should. If so, we know very well on what page of history it'll go down and who will be right beside it, along with those who praise it or, for that matter, even tolerate it. One might at least mention the counterparts that immediately come to mind, like, for example, the Russian destruction of Grozny 10 years ago. It's a city of about the same size. Or Srebrenica, which is almost universally described as genocide in the West. In that case, as we know in detail from an extensive Dutch government report and other sources, this Muslim enclave in Serb territory, which was very lightly protected, was being used as a base for attacks against Serb villages. And when the anticipated reaction took place, it was horrendous. The Serbs drove out all but military age men and then moved in to kill them. Well, that's familiar. That's Fallujah, basically, but there are some differences. Women and children were not bombed out of Srebrenica, as in the Fallujah case, but they were trucked out. And there will be no extensive efforts, we can be sure of that, to exhume the last possible corpse of the pack rats and their warrens in Fallujah. And there are other differences which are arguably unfair to the Serbs. Well, it could be argued that all this is irrelevant. The Nuremberg Tribunal, spelling out the UN Charter, declared that, quoting it, initiation of a war of aggression is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole, hence the war crimes in Fallujah, Abu Ghraib, and so on. Those judged to have played any role in the supreme crime, for example, the German foreign minister, were sentenced to death by hanging. And the Tokyo Tribunal was far more severe. Actually, there's an important book on this topic. If you haven't read it, you should, by the Canadian international lawyer Michael Mandel, who reviews in, unfortunately, convincing detail how the powerful have become self-immunized from international law. In fact, the Nuremberg Tribunal itself established this principle of self-immunity. To bring the Nazi criminals to justice, it was necessary to devise definitions of war crime and crime against humanity. They hadn't existed precisely in international law. And how this was done is explained candidly by Telford Taylor, who was the chief counsel for the prosecution at Nuremberg and a distinguished international lawyer and historian. So I'll quote him. Since both sides in World War II had played the terrible game of urban destruction, the Allies far more successfully, there was no basis for criminal charges against Germans and Japanese, and in fact, no such charges were brought. Aerial bombardment had been used so extensively and ruthlessly on the Allied side as well as the Axis side that neither at Nuremberg nor Tokyo was the issue made a part of the trials. So in other words, it goes on like this, the operative definition of crime is crime that you committed and we did not. And to underscore that fact, Nazi war criminals were absolved if the defense could show that their US counterparts carried out the same crimes. Taylor concludes from this that to punish the foe, especially the vanquished foe, for conduct in which the enforcer nation has engaged would be so grossly inequitable as to discredit the laws themselves, which is correct, but the operative definition also discredits the laws themselves, along with all subsequent tribunals which follow the same principle. Taylor provides this background as part of his explanation of why US bombing in Vietnam was not a war crime. And his argument is plausible, further discrediting the laws themselves. Some of the subsequent tribunals are discredited in perhaps even more extreme ways, such as the Yugoslavia versus NATO case, which is now being adjudicated by the International Court of Justice, World Court. The US was excused, correctly, on the basis of the argument that it is not subject to the jurisdiction of the court in this case. The reason is that when the United States signed the Genocide Convention, which is at issue here, the US finally did sign it after 40 years, it signed it with a reservation saying that it is inapplicable to the United States. And the rules of the World Court say that they can only deal with something if both sides are subjected to its jurisdiction. Now, there was an outraged comment on the efforts of the Justice Department lawyers to demonstrate that the president has the right to authorize torture, a comment by the dean of Yale Law School, Howard Koh, and he said that the notion that the president has the constitutional power to permit torture is like saying that he has the constitutional power to commit genocide. Well, the president's legal advisors, like the new attorney general, should have little difficulty arguing that the president indeed does have that power if the second superpower, it's us, permits him to exercise it.